Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. So the Alec Baldwin trial has begun. Opening statements have been given by the prosecution. As far as I know at this point, I don't know if the defense has gotten to give their opening statements. But we're going to talk about what the gist of this whole case is. And it's been in the news now for close to, 3 years or so. And as we know, Helena Hutchins is the person who lost her life due to criminally negligence. And this person right here on the screen, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer for this case, is now serving 18 months in a state prison, having been convicted of criminally negligent homicide. You're going to hear a lot of talk about this firearm there, and people incorrectly refer to it as a prop gun, but it definitely fits the definition of a firearm, which is any loaded weapon which is capable of firing a projectile. And this certainly did that, costing Helena Hutchins her life and severely injuring Joel Souza. So there's Helena Hutchins right there. And she is the cinematographer, of course, in this case, who lost her life. And we're going to talk about many things involving this case, but what it really all comes down to is, did this person who's being charged right now, Alec Baldwin, did he point the firearm at her? Did he pull the trigger? And did his actions cause her death in a criminally negligent way? That basically is the whole case. And we're going to discuss that. I'm going to have, of course, with me today, my co-host, retired NYPD Sergeant Michael Geary, professor at Albertus Magnus College, also an attorney. And he's going to shed a lot of light on this in regards to the legal aspects of this case. Anyway, hold on to your hats. Hold on to your wig, your toupee. Hold on to your service dog, your family members, your friends. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone. You're entering the police off-the-cuff zone.
There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant, Michael Byder.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
Without further ado, I want to bring Professor Michael Geary, retired NYPD Sergeant Attorney Michael Geary, onto the show right away because we don't want to beat around the bush. We want to get right to it. Mike, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Billy. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for watching the show.
Well, Mike, thank you for being available because we just decided at a specific time and said, let's do it. Let's go live. So, Mike, it's somewhat simple, but I think the defense will try to make this, of course, that's their job, make this more complex than it really is. And I think simplistically, me, of course, not being an attorney, can make this boil down to, did he point the firearm at her? Did he pull the trigger? Did he fail to check the firearm, even though, you know, many movie people will say that's not his job. That's the armorer's job. The gun was handed from the armorer to the assistant director. That's a violation of rules and movie protocol and safety. But more importantly, He never checked the gun. People will say that's not his job. I differ. I believe that is your job. Firearm safety, it's always, and I repeat it numerous times, we're taught for the firearms range before we holster our unloaded weapon, we're taught to do a visual and a physical inspection of that firearm to make sure it's loaded. Your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, Billy, this is what Alec Baldwin's going to do. He's going to say Miss Hannah Gutierrez Reed was the one who owed the duty to make sure that as the onset armorer, that everything was done properly, that he had many other duties that he had to attend to as a producer and as the star of the movie. And therefore, when at the moment that he pulled the trigger, he had reasonable belief, no reason to believe otherwise, that that gun was a cold gun, meaning it was unloaded, that it wasn't even loaded with blanks. It wasn't even loaded with some sort of explosive, fake round or something like that. That was just going to make a flashbang, nothing like that. So he's going to put all the blame on Miss Hannah Gutierrez Reed, who's already serving time for manslaughter. So for him, he's going to say, at the moment I acted, I was acting not recklessly, but I was acting following the advice of the people who were I hired to depend on. And so therefore, I simply did what I had done many times in many movies. I pointed the gun. We were trying to figure out blocking the scene and how we should have the lighting and everything. And therefore, I pulled the trigger. I didn't believe that I had pulled the trigger at the time. I was in such denial. It's ridiculous, but I realize now I must have maybe touched that trigger just enough pressure with the gun cocked. But that should not be considered reckless because I had relied on all these other people. So he's going to distance himself.
But Mike, let me interrupt you for 1 second. What makes you think that he would ever admit to having his finger on that trigger? Why would he ever do that?
Well, I think depending on the video that exists, because they were doing the practicing, so there might be some video of him drawing the gun, drawing it, and holstering it while they were blocking the camera angles and everything. If there's existing something like that where you could see where he actually had his finger on the trigger rather than on his finger on the side of the trigger guard, that would show that in his mind he didn't realize that he's not experienced with firearms. He's not going to the outdoor range several times a year. He's not he doesn't have that familiarity with firearms. He might have thought his finger was actually touching the trigger guard. So therefore, he's going to say, I had my finger against what I thought maybe was a trigger guard. I didn't realize that I pulled the trigger because I never thought in my wildest imagination, because there was no need to pull the trigger. I was figuring how I was going to pull the gun out slowly. The gun, maybe the scene called for me to cock the firearm in a threatening manner. That sort of thing. And, not being a person who is really familiar with firearms, I'm in total shock. I could never possibly believe that I touched that trigger. I could never possibly believe it. I think he's going to have to concede that he was totally wrong. And it's going to be like a little bit of a please to the jury. Understand. Yeah. When I said those things to Juror Stephanopoulos, I was in total shock. I could not.
Well, Mike, what makes you think he's going to testify? I mean, they'll never find these things out unless he testifies.
I think they're going to see the video can be shown because that's absolutely part of the prosecution's case. But I think he likes to be on stage. I think he likes to be the center of attention. And if you actually do think you are innocent, I think the natural urge is to get up in front of the jury and say, I am totally innocent. I should not have been charged. It's a terrible, terrible thing that happened. But, I'm not guilty of a criminal act whatsoever. I want to tell my story. I think there's that natural urge. And he is a little bit of a narcissist. He's a bit of a self-centered person. I think he's going to want to do it. And I think that's where I'm guessing. I think he's going to want to be center stage.
Mike, I think any lawyer worth his fee or any lawyer worth his diploma is going to advise him not to testify.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If he pushes to testify, I think that's a huge, huge mistake. The other thing, I just want to get back to the main things that, A, the FBI did the ballistics tests on this gun. They have said that he undoubtedly pulled the trigger. So science now is telling us that he pulled the trigger. As you previously stated, there is video of him practicing before the gun actually was fired, drawing the gun, and his finger was on the trigger. You could clearly see that in the video. So do not denying it, deny, I don't think is going to help him in this case. So establishing the criminal negligence, and is it criminally negligent? Is that criminal? Is it a felony? Yeah, it is a felony. And as we saw in the case of Hannah Gutierrez Reed, you can get real prison time, which she was sentenced to 18 months in prison, which is the same sentence if Alec Baldwin gets convicted that he is eligible for. Now, there are many, many arguments the defense can have. And of course, now, because of all the tests the FBI did on this firearm, the gun was rendered inoperable because they were beating it with a mallet. They were, because they wanted to show that no matter what happened, the gun would not go off when it was cocked. So if you hit it, you dropped it, it would not go off. So the only way it would go off is if the person holding it pulled the trigger. So the defense now can argue, wait a minute, we can't even test that gun. We can't have our own experts testify to this. So we have to believe you. So that's a big argument from them, but I don't know if the judge will allow it or the jury will buy it. What do you think?
I think, Billy, the fact that the FBI rendered the gun inoperable in some way.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
It's laughable. In some ways, it's tragic because even though Baldwin's defense team lost their motion to throw out the indictment based on the fact that the firearm, the quintessential thing, the most important thing here, has been rendered inoperable. The judge said, nope. All the tests are going to be admissible, and it's up to you to do the best you can. You could always appeal this later on, but whatever happens, you're going to have a fair run at that expert, that FBI expert, and do whatever you have to do to try to make them look bad. That's your cure. Now, it's as you and I know, and Phil knows, if you have a double action revolver, and you use a single action, you pull back the hammer, it doesn't take much pressure to release that hammer onto the primer. However, it does take some pressure. It might be 2 pounds of pressure compared to, say, maybe 6 pounds of pressure if you're shooting double action. I think in this case, with that kind of gun, I think that's a replica Pieta, which is supposed to look like a Colt, and I think it's designed to be single action. I think it actually is. So you cock the firearm, and you have to shoot. Every bullet is, you have to fire single action, like a real old time Western gun. And I think that just a little bit of pressure. Now, we were told in the NYPD you could cock a firearm and drop it from, like, you know, a second floor window, and it won't go off. You've got to have the direct pressure on that trigger. And so therefore, he's going to make a lot of hay over what the FBI did. It may hurt them in front of the eyes of the jury, but you're dealing in New Mexico, and people probably have a lot more familiarity with firearms than, say, if you were up in say Manhattan here, or in Long Island. So therefore, it may, they're going to have their run, and they're going to score a few points. But the inoperability of that gun now, it's kind of sad. I understand why the judge did what they did, but I could understand the Baldwin team screaming, holy hell, because the FBI actually broke the gun. So that's going to be a very contentious issue when it comes to that part of the case, when the prosecution introduces that testimony of that FBI agent, and that FBI agent is going to get their butt chewed off by Baldwin's defense team.
Mike, before we go to the opening statement by prosecutor Linda Johnson, there was one issue decided by the judge yesterday that I think is very important, and it was a victory for Alec Baldwin and his attorneys. And the decision was that the judge said, and I'll put it in layman's terms, that he could not be considered criminally negligent as his role as a producer on the film, just his actions. So she threw that out. No, you can't say that he was responsible for everyone else's actions. I'm going to take that off the table. Your thoughts with that?
Billy, it's a big win for Baldwin, because now the case boils down to only his actions and his thoughts at the moment that scene started, when he was practicing that morning. That's it. Everything else, labor issues, misfirings with some other firearms, hazardous handling of firearms by people on the set, Ms. Hannah Gutierrez reads, previous maybe issues with her lack of experience, all labor issues, all those other things. The fact that I think New Mexico found them guilty of violating certain state labor standards and fined them like $100,000, whatever it happens to be. All that stuff is not going to be heard by the jury. The fact is the jury has already read the newspapers. They've all heard this stuff before. There's no way that they don't know about it in the back of their minds. But supposedly for this case, they're supposed to disregard all that they know about that, and there will be no testimony involving that whatsoever. So it's a big win for Baldwin, because he only has to concentrate on one thing now, and it boils the case down to just the absolute essentials of what happened on that scene. I think it's fair. The judge is trying to be fair. The judge is doing their best, and if it comes out that for instance Baldwin isn't convicted, and say he's acquitted, or there's a hung jury, the prosecution will have a second bite at the apple. Or if it's acquitted, nothing further. But the judge is trying to do their best. The judge has a lot of discretion when it comes down to make these pre-trial decisions that affect the actual trial. This is all done outside the purview of the jury, outside the public's purview. Very few people know about it, but it's the way for the judge to say, look, we're going to concentrate on one thing and one thing only. What happened that morning? Nothing else. And I think for Baldwin, it's a big victory.
Okay. Erica Olson from the chat. This is a perfect storm case. If Hannah and David Hall had done their jobs correctly, if Alec had checked the gun himself, if the medics in hospital had intubated Helena correctly, she'd be alive. Erica, I'm going to have to disagree with you about that. We'll hear right now, when I play the prosecutor, or Linda Johnson's opening statement, the bullet severed her spinal cord. You're not going to live when that happens. So whatever the treatment was to try to save her life, I don't think they would have been able to save her life. If your spinal cord is severed, I'm pretty sure you're going to die, And so all those other things you said were correct. I'm going to have to disagree with you. And then we're going to play the prosecutor's, or Linda Johnson's, opening statement right now.
Make believe with a real gun in a real life workplace. And while playing make believe with that gun violates the cardinal rules of firearm safety, people's lives are endangered and someone could be killed. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what this case is about. It's simple, it's straightforward. The evidence will show that someone who played make-believe with a real gun and violated the cardinal rules of firearm safety is the defendant, Alexander Baldwin. You will hear over the course of the next few days that in the fall of 2021, a movie called Rust began filming at the Bonanza Creek Ranch just south of Santa Fe in Santa Fe County. You will learn that this movie was a Western with a lot of gun action. And while it was a movie set, it was a real life workplace for many people. But you will hear this workplace was on a tight budget. And you will learn that some of the people who were hired to work at this workplace were very inexperienced. And one of those was the armorer, a very young woman named Hannah Gutierrez Reed. You will hear testimony from crew members who worked on the set, who will tell you that to them, Ms. Gutierrez's inexperience was obvious. You will also learn that this workplace has some talented people. And one of those was the director of photography, a vibrant 42-year-old rising star named Helena Hutchins. You will also learn that the director of this film was Joel Souza, another talented individual who cares deeply for his projects. The evidence will show, ladies and gentlemen, that like in many workplaces, there are people who act in a reckless manner and place other individuals in danger and act without due regard for the safety of others. That, you will hear, was the defendant, Alexander Baldwin, the lead actor on this film. You will learn that this movie began filming on or about October 6, 2021. But the defendant did not arrive on set to begin working until about October 13. And you will learn that prior to arriving on the set to work, he requested to be assigned the biggest gun available. So he was assigned this revolver, a replica of an 1873 single action revolver manufactured by Pieta Firearms in Italy. You will hear from Alessandro Pieta, who will tell you he manufactured this gun. And he will tell you he manufactured it in 2015. And he will explain the quality control measures that Pieta Firearms follows in order to ensure that firearms that are manufactured by Pieta Firearms don't have any problems or issues. Mr. Pieta will tell you that this firearm he himself manufactured, and that when Pieta sent it to EMF, which is the company that distributes firearms for Pieta Firearms in the United States, this gun was in perfect working condition. You will hear from Justin Neal, who is a representative of EMF, a company out of California that has historically been known to provide firearms to the movie industry. Mr. Neal will tell you that when EMF received this firearm in 2017, it was in perfect working order. And in fact, when EMF had this firearm, it was subjected to numerous quality control inspections because it was used as a show gun at gun shows. The evidence will show that in September of 2021, an individual by the name of Seth Kenny was contacted by the folks with Rust Production. They asked Mr. Kenny if he would be able to provide some firearms for the filming, for use during the filming of Rust. You will learn that Mr. Kenny owns PDQ Firearm and Prop. It's a duly licensed firearms dealership. Mr. Kenny then contacted EMF and ordered several single action replica revolvers. And in September, or on September 29, 2021, Mr. Kenny purchased this gun. And you will hear that Mr. Kenny received it from EMF and it was in perfect working order. The only thing that Mr. Kenny did to this gun was to insert the firing pin. Because since it was a show gun, it didn't have a firing pin. But you'll learn that that's a very easy step. All he had to do was just insert the pin and that's it. And then Mr. Kenny had the firearms, this one and some other firearms, transferred to the set of Rust at the Bonanza Creek Ranch.
So, Mike, what is the prosecutor, Alinda Johnson, what is she doing here? Let us let our audience know what she's doing here.
Okay. What she's doing is letting the jury know that this gun, there's no possible way that this gun malfunctioned, that this gun had a any sort of characteristics that would make it unsafe, that from the moment it was built, the moment it was inspected, the moment it was transferred to America, the moment it got to PDQ firearms, it was in perfect working order. And therefore, she's laying the groundwork for the argument that the only possible way this gun could have been discharged, could have discharged a bullet, was the fact that someone pulled the trigger and no other way. There's no one can make an argument that this gun just went off on its own. It just spontaneously fired. No. So that's what she's doing, letting the jury know it's all about Alec Baldwin. It's nothing about this gun. Don't anybody think that this gun, no matter what the, but he may say, his defense team may say, this gun was an absolute perfect working order, the way it was designed to work, and it was perfectly safe.
You know, Mike, someone in the chat asked, we were trying to explain before that in some of the tests that the FBI did, which was concluded beating the gun with a mallet.
Yes.
They were basically trying to see if it would go off.
Right.
It was cocked back, loaded, and they hit it, and they did all kinds of tests. Those tests rendered it inoperable. I've never heard that done before.
Yes.
But crazy. I think that they were trying to go the extreme route with that so that it would totally eliminate the defense to say, oh, it could have just went off through a malfunction or, you know, an earthquake or whatever. But they were trying to eliminate that possibility. And with that, I don't want to stay on it, but that's what rendered the gun inoperable. So I want to go back to the prosecutor's opening statement.
And on October 13th, 2021, the defendant was supposed to have a training session with this gun and this young armorer. But you will see that during this training session, the defendant had somebody or a couple of people filming him while he's running around shooting this gun. You will learn, ladies and gentlemen, or you'll hear during this trial, the use of the words prop gun. And you'll learn a prop gun is this real gun. It's not a toy. It's not made of rubber. It's a real gun.
You know, Mike, we defined before, and that's why I was a little bothered where a lot of broadcasters were saying the prop gun, because the New York State definition of a firearm right out of the penal law is any loaded weapon that is capable of firing a projectile. That is it. Very simple. Right. So if a loaded weapon is capable of firing a projectile, it's a firearm, not That's a prop right. gun. Maybe you could call it a prop gun if the barrel was blocked and was incapable of firing a projectile. Then maybe you could call it a prop gun. But this, in every sense of the word, is a firearm, not a prop gun. I think that's important to draw that distinction.
Oh, 100%. All you have to do, like she alluded to, the fact that you take out the firing pin and you render this operable firearm inoperable because therefore it's no longer capable of discharging a round. I wish they actually had used prop guns, maybe real guns that had the pin taken out, or as you say, the barrel's blocked or something else. The fact that they were actually using a real 45 Pieta, which looks like an old army Colt, you know, a 45 slug is not something like a tiny little 22. This thing is huge. And it's a big, slow P piece of lead coming right at you. And it's really dangerous. And so the idea that they would actually take a real gun and not have the firing pin out of it, you know, or doing something else, or having a prop gun with rounds that just make a lot of noise, to me is crazy. But this is playing, I hate to use a stupid term, but it's like Russian roulette. You're just looking for something to go wrong. And it's terrible. It's a real firearm. It's not a prop gun. It's terrible.
Connie G, if a live round was not in the gun, no one would have been killed. Connie G, you're 100% right.
That's right.
And that's why Hannah Gutierrez is in prison right now. Because she's the one that put that live round in the cylinder. But, and there's a couple of buts here, there was more criminal negligence to go around. And that part of the criminal negligence was this man, the assistant director, David Halls, who did not check the gun after it was handed to him. He shouldn't even have been the one handing the gun to Alec Baldwin. It should have been the armorer. So just the armorer would should be 100% responsible, not handing it to an assistant director. But that's what happened. Now, let's see if there's more negligence. You can agree or disagree. Is the person handed the gun, the actor, is it part of his responsibility to check that gun? I say yes. Many people could say he was told it was a cold gun. That does that absolve him of responsibility? That's what this whole trial is about. And we'll see. Let me go back to the opening statement of the prosecutor.
You will also see evidence, ladies and gentlemen, that during the days before that fateful October 21st day, the defendant handled this firearm multiple occasions. You will see video footage of the defendant firing this firearm, working perfectly fine. But you'll see evidence, ladies and gentlemen, that each time the defendant handled this firearm, he did not do a safety check with that inexperienced armorer. And you'll hear that the reason he didn't do a safety check is because he didn't want to offend her. The evidence you will see will paint a real life picture of a real life workplace where this defendant mishandled this gun. You will see him using this gun as a pointer to point at people, to point at things. You will see him cock the hammer when he's not supposed to cock the hammer. You will see him put his finger on the trigger when his finger's not supposed to be on the trigger. You will hear about numerous breaches of firearm safety with this defendant and this use of this firearm. And the evidence will show that on the morning of October 21st, 2021, the camera crew walked off set. And you will learn that one of the reasons that camera crew walked out is because they were concerned over safety breaches with the use of firearms. The evidence will show that the morning of October 21st started out a couple of hours behind. They filmed some scenes at this church on the Bonanza Creek Ranch. And you will see that one of those scenes required the defendant to pull out his gun. This was in the morning. Pull out his gun, and you'll hear the director tell him, pull it out and hold it. And the first time, you'll see evidence the defendant does what the director tells him. But you will hear the director tell you that many times the defendant would do his own thing. So then the director in the morning asked him, okay, do it again, just like you did now. The defendant pulls out the gun, but this time he cocks the hammer. The evidence will show they then broke for lunch. And around 1:30 or so, they came back to this church to do what's called a blocking. The evidence will show that Ms. Hutchins wanted to do a blocking for an insert. And you will learn what a blocking is, just working out the details
of the moves of the actor. Wasn't even a rehearsal. You will hear from one of the witnesses who walked into the church and saw the defendant kind of playing with his gun. And then you will see evidence or hear evidence that Ms. Hutchins and Mr. Souza were talking to the defendant about doing this insert. And the insert was just supposed to be from here to here. And it was supposed to be of the defendant just slowly taking his gun out of this holster, out of his holster, and just holding it at an angle. The evidence will show that someone asked the armorer to bring the defendant's gun to him. And she did. She brought it into the church, showed it to David Halls, who you will learn was the first assistant director. The gun was empty. Ms. Gutierrez then handed the gun to the defendant. But then you will hear that Ms. Gutierrez was given the gun back, and she took it and loaded it with dummy rounds. And what you will learn is that dummy rounds are inert rounds. They look like real rounds, but they are very easy to tell that they are not because they'll rattle. Ms. Gutierrez then went back to the church, showed the revolver to the first assistant director very fast. They only checked about 3 rounds, very quick. And they missed 1 round. You will learn that one of the rounds in that revolver was a real round. And the evidence will show that Ms. Gutierrez then handed the gun to the defendant. And what you will learn is that once again, the defendant failed to do a gun check or a safety check with this armor. So he takes the firearm, puts it in his holster. Then Ms. Hutchins and Mr. Souza were doing this blocking. And the evidence will show, ladies and gentlemen, that the defendant again did his own thing. You will hear from an individual by the name of Kent Jorgensen. Mr. Jorgensen will tell you that he's been involved in drafting and revising movie set safety rules. You will learn that these movie set safety rules require actors like the defendant to treat every firearm as though it's loaded, to never point a firearm at another person, and to never put your finger on the trigger unless you're prepared to shoot or to destroy whatever's in front of you. The evidence will show that on October 21st, 2021, after that lunch break, the defendant once again violated those set safety rules. And during this blocking, the director had instructed him to just slowly take out that gun and just hold it at an angle. But you will see that the defendant takes it out quickly the first time, points it. And you will hear witness testimony who will tell you the first time he does it, his finger is on or around the trigger. He does it again, takes it out very fast, points it. And once again, you will hear testimony that his finger was on or around the trigger. And the evidence will show that that third and fatal time, he takes it out once again, fast. Hammer's cocked, he cocks the hammer, points it straight at Ms. Hutchins, and fires that gun, sending that live bullet right into Ms. Hutchins' body. You will learn that this bullet was a 45 caliber round that entered Ms. Hutchins' body right underneath her right underarm.
Oh, Mike, how effective was that opening statement by Prosecutor Alinda Johnson?
If I'm the judge, I'm rolling my eyes. If I'm the defense attorney, I'm objecting to any mention at all of labor issues on that set. If I was the defense attorney, I'd be objecting, trying to throw her off her game, trying to get her off out of her rhythm, because I would, when she started mentioning that, she just went over it quickly. I was like shaking my head going, stand up, object, 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 throw her off her game. I thought it was too lengthy, and I don't like it when defense attorneys or prosecutors start telling the jury what the witnesses are going to say. Let the witnesses say what they're going to say. And she talked about the firearm expert is going to tell you that about the gun being perfectly operable, you know, all that stuff. I mean, a little too much to me, a little too much. If I was a judge, I'd be like, you know, stop it, stop, stop, move on, move on, move on, move on, move on. Don't sit there and put your own words as a prosecutor into the witness's mouths. Don't do that. So I thought it was a little too long. If I'm a juror on that case, I'm like, you know, come on, let's get to the testimony. Let's get to the testimony here. So I don't like it when judges give way, way too much time for opening statements. I believe in being succinct, make your point, move on. Don't sit there and just keep on going. And I think the defense attorney missed a great opportunity to stop her in her tracks.
You know, I think that she laid a lot of the argument that no doubt the defense is going to go after. And she sort of set the stage for what they're going to use as a defense. But look, this case, although it's going to be made more complicated than it actually is, it's about three different issues. Mm-hmm. Did he pull the trigger? And the FBI, in their ballistics test, says, yes, the gun could not have gone off without him pulling the trigger. In video and still photos, you could see his finger is on the trigger. Should he have checked the firearm? Yeah. In my opinion, yes, he should have. Was he negligent, criminally negligent, in pointing the firearm at another human being? All three, I think you check the box. Now, if the jury buys all of those things, then he will be found guilty. If they do not, if his defense can build a platform for him and say, no, he wasn't responsible for this, then he'll be found innocent. Nighthawk, thank you so much for the $9.99 super sticker. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, please go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and ring that bell. If you want to contribute to us financially, we have a Patreon with four different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels. We appreciate all you guys and all the support that you do give us. Pamela White, thank you so much for the $5 super sticker. Much, much, much appreciated. Guys, I try to answer the questions as they come up. Tom Keen, yesterday, I believe the judge told the prosecutor and defense they had a limit of 50 minutes each for their opening statements. Well, she definitely didn't go 50 minutes. Let me play a little bit now, of course, of the defense. And I don't know exactly if this is the entire rebuttal to the prosecution, but let me play some of this here.
Fixed that firearm onto a fixed platform and then struck the firearm on six different planes with a rubber mallet. And Mr. Ziegler explained to Mr. Haig that he had not affixed the mallet to another fixed device. Instead, he did it freehand. Mr. Haig will tell you, with his 50 plus years of experience as a firearms forensics expert, he opined or concluded that those very tiny microscopic diagonal lines on the surface of the trigger sear were likely caused by the FBI's accidental discharge. The evidence will show, ladies and gentlemen, that regardless of how those tiny microscopic lines got on that trigger sear, these firearms experts will tell you that those would not affect the functionality of this firearm.
try to tarnish him in your eyes. But that's not what happened here. On this set, there was a real bullet, something that should never be on a movie set, something which has nothing to do with making a movie. And you will hear no evidence, not one word, that Alec Baldwin had anything to do with that real bullet being brought onto that set. The second critical issue in this case is, why did a real bullet get loaded into a prop movie gun? It is undisputed that the bullet was loaded into the gun by the armorer, the person on set whose responsibility it was to ensure the gun was safe. And so picture that moment of the armorer placing a live bullet into that firearm. You know, you hear the prosecutor say, you know, he did this, or he performed in a certain way. He picked out the biggest gun as his prop. It's to tarnish him in your eyes. You will hear no evidence whatsoever. No evidence that anything Mr. Baldwin did, that something he did in that moment, that horrible moment when she put that bullet in that gun, none of it had anything to do with Alec Baldwin. And finally, the first assistant director's job, the head of safety, Dave Halls, checks it before it goes to the actor. And he will tell you he made a tragic mistake. He failed to detect the live bullet. And Alec Baldwin had nothing to do with that either. So all this evidence that the prosecutor just outlined, all of it, has nothing to do with these critical issues. Nothing. Which leads us to this. The evidence will show that on a movie set, safety has to occur before the gun is placed in the actor's hands. In this case, this unique case on a movie set, the prop gun was placed in Mr. Baldwin's hands and cold gun was announced, meaning it had been checked and double-checked by those responsible to ensure the gun was safe. It was just a prop. They all thought it was just a prop and could do no harm. The actor's job is to act, to rehearse, to choreograph his moves, to memorize his lines. He's Harlan Rust. He's an outlaw running for his life, who in the incident in question, he's pulling a six-shooter to try to defend himself. That's why the gun has to be safe before it gets into the actor's hands. His mind is somewhere else, in the being of another, a century away, an outlaw. He must be able to take that weapon and use it as the person he's acting with. To wave it, to point it, to pull the trigger like actors do, in ways that would be lethal in the real world, but are not lethal on a movie set. And I'm going to show you that scene now before lunch. And if you could just play action.
You need to go find some help.
I don't need no damn help.
You're
going to
die if
you
don't.
He's wounded on the run. Play again.
Continue. Harlan Rust. You can stand up nice and slow. Toss him the weapon you have.
He's on the church pew, bleeding, his hand gripping the revolver. He could defend himself against the men in the movie. What?
One more. You good?
Ready? Ready. Marlon Rust. You can get up nice and slow, tell us what you have. Go the only way to keep that line, so he lands, the camera lands.
Yep. Which way, camera right or left? The camera left here.
I'll stand right here for
so,
you, Alex.
So whip it out. Okay, well, let me get this all greased. Ready? Okay, ready? Okay, ready? Ready.
And set.
Harlan Rust.
You want him to do it again. There's no danger. They want him to do it again.
And set, ready, and action.
Island rest. Nice.
You know, Mike, I understand why the defense attorney is trying to present this argument, but it's an argument between fantasy and reality, which really a movie is a fantasy. It's not a real depiction of life. However, where reality slams like a speeding freight train into the side of a building, is that the reality is that someone lost their life during this fantasy shoot. And calling, again, the defense is calling this a prop gun. We just discussed how this is not a prop gun. This fits the definition of firearm, which is any loaded weapon that is capable of firing a projectile. And again, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, guilty. She put those rounds in the gun. David Halls, guilty. This is the third one. This is the third criminally negligent, potentially. I'm not on the jury. This is the third potentially criminally negligent cast member of this fantasy, Rust, that has nothing to do with reality except the cinematographer lost her life. And the movie's director, Joel Souza, was shot in the shoulder. So that's where fantasy, like a speeding freight train, hits reality. Your thoughts?
Billy, I thought that it was really strange that the judge would allow a critical piece of, you know, what was considered evidence, because it shows the mental state of everyone involved on that movie set at that critical moment, to be shown during opening statement. If I was a judge, I'd be like, no, wait, you know, that we are not doing any sort of introduction of evidence at this point. You got 55 minutes, state your case, talk about whatever you want to talk about, you know, within certain limitations. I thought the judge was very, to allow that was very interesting. I never thought that I would see that. I certainly wouldn't want to do that if I was a judge. But I think the defense attorney did was say, look, I think he talked very slowly, talked very distinctly. He talked about the fact that Hannah Gutierrez was the armorer. Mr. Halls was the second assistant, was the assistant there. He said he's in charge of safety on the set. And therefore, he touched it. He told Alec, you know, it's a cold gun. Alec is trying to be in his Rust mindset. He's thinking like an actor at that point. I think he made that very clear. And therefore, he's got to handle the firearm in a way that Harlan Rust would do if he was confronted by a lawman out in the Old West. He's no longer thinking about safety protocols. He's thinking like an actor. So his mental state is detached. He's in character. He's not the producer at that split second. He's an actor taking directions. And strangely, at the end of that, when he pulled the firearm that last time, you could see clearly he'd cocked the firearm with his thumb. His finger was clearly on the trigger. And clearly you could hear someone in the background saying, like, great, you know, good job. Like, that's the way we want it. Like, you did an excellent job. And so therefore, you know, he's like, okay, in his mind, this is what the defense attorney is saying, is that he's in the mode. He's in the period. He's acting like Harlan. This is what Harlan would do. So you can't blame him for what he did. So that's the defense's take on this. Very interesting. Very, very interesting in this case, the way the judge and everybody is handling this very first day. Very interesting.
Let's go back to the statement.
It's a scene similar to scenes we've all seen in movies and television, performed by thousands of actors. And the scene that continues after lunch is the same scene. It's just not, unfortunately, captured on videotape. And the scene they envisioned and acted out, that prop gun was positioned in the afternoon so close to the camera that you could see inside, that you could feel it. You could feel that it was loaded. And it was loaded, of course, with dummies.
dummies to make it look like a real gun. But this one time, one of those dummies was a real bullet. The real bullet was not known to anyone in that church. Amongst the actors, directors, and crew in the scene, everyone was doing exactly how they go about their business every day on a movie, not as if some lethal element had been included in the environment. You will see creativity and movement and everyone talking and vibrant. No one had any idea that this venomous, toxic element had been inserted into this magic they were creating. But it did. It entered that place. It killed an amazing person. It wounded another, and it changed lives forever. And so to find out what happened on that movie set, you need to do something that the prosecutors could never do. You have to step back and remember what they were doing on a movie set. What were Helena Hutchins, the cinematographer, Joel Souza, the director, and Alec Baldwin, the actor, doing on Bonanza Creek Ranch? You know, movies and magic have always been closely associated. The first people that made movies were magicians. And this imagination that happens in movies, you know, King Kong, he can stand above a city, and Superman can fly, horses and snakes and gun battles. For this to all work, for cinematography, what Helena did to work, for acting to work, you have to be so close to the barrier of real and imagined that the viewer feels that they're there, that it's real. The viewer can't see strings from the stuntman. The stuntman must leap. The snake must hiss. And guns happen in movies all over this country for many decades. Bang, bang. You've all seen it. Guns have been an element of theater and film and television since the earliest of times. Depictions of war and combat, Spartacus, it stirs audiences because it feels real. Later films, Platoon, Apocalypse Now, they showed the unvarnished realities of war. This ranch, Santa Fe, it had been the scene to many gunfights and movie scenes well before Alec was even born. Laramie, Butch and the Sundance Kid, and these Westerns.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
There's the first objection. The prosecutor is approaching the bench along with the defense attorney, probably to object to this line of questioning, or this line of presentation, I should say, not questioning.
The evidence will show that guns are in movies because movies are about people's lives and guns are in people's lives. So let's talk about the evidence and how the lethal bullet got there. How did this happen and how did it unfold? The evidence will be the following. Everybody on a movie set has a role. The armorer armors, the director directs, the actor acts. They work in harmony, but they have a division of responsibility. Safety being important has the first assistant director, whose name is Dave Halls, above the armorer and is sort of the safety of the set. And on that day in question, the cast and the creative directors and crew in the church, it's a fake church. Their actors are not in their normal clothes, it's costumes. There's debris falling from the ceiling, it's fake debris. And they yell out cold gun. And that is an important term you're gonna learn in this case. It means that the gun is cold. No one need worry. But even that requires a little bit more explanation. Cold gun doesn't mean no live bullets. There are for sure 100% no live bullets on movie sets. That's unimaginable. Cold means you don't even have the fake blank poof in it. You don't need to worry even about, you know, eye gear or earplugs for that fake bang. It means it's empty, inert, cosmetic, can do no harm. Cold guns can't hurt people. It's impossible. Literally impossible for a cold gun to hurt somebody. You could hurt you more by dropping it on your foot. And that's why these artists are carrying on in their art. Cold gun, all clear to go. And the armorer on this set hands a prop gun to Alec, like she had done times before, like people have done with him in movies for a generation. And he's there. He's in the movie set church with his movie set gear and his holster, and he takes his movie set gun. And he's deeply focused in that moment on his character. The artists, the crew members, they're moving around him. Again, no eye gear or earplugs, nothing to protect against. They carry on. They practice. They rehearse. They take a lunch break. Some folks leave. Some don't. They continue the scene. Dave Halls, the head of safety, is actually practicing the movement so they can frame. They can frame the footage that will happen after lunch. And the prop cold gun comes back. The prop cold gun comes back. Cold gun. They call it again. Same gun, again, safe. The first assistant director, Dave Halls, head of safety for the entire film, a man with decades of experience, comes and takes the additional step and inspects the gun. Verifies again, cold gun. Everyone relax. Go back to focus on the making of a movie. There's nothing in the gun that can hurt anybody. And Alex sits on that pew. And they, the creative directors, the crew, they're moving around him, in front of him. And Harlan Rust, he begins, like the prosecutor told you, rehearsing, acting. This is a completely mundane, uneventful routine act on a movie set. On a movie set. And so everybody carries on. Nobody fathomed, imagined, foresaw any possible danger. They moved around Alec as he practiced his draw. As the prosecutor put it, working out the details of the move and the actor. He does it. Does it again, does it in a different way. Nobody bats an eye. And they will tell you that the investigation revealed that Baldwin was practicing drawing and pointing the weapon of the scene with guidance and instruction from Helena Hutchins and Joel Souza. The gun goes off. Everybody's shocked. Alec is startled. He immediately says, I didn't pull the trigger, immediately. What the hell just happened? They collectively exclaim. Shock turns to panic. 911 is called.
Sanofi Fire and EMS, what's the location of the emergency?
Bonanza Creek Ranch has had two people accidentally shot on a movie set by a prop gun. We need help immediately, okay? For this fucking AD that yelled at me at lunch because asking about revisions, this motherfucker. Did you see him lean over my desk and yell at me? He's got the gun. He's responsible for what happened.
Are you supposed to now, Mimi?
No. I'm a strip supervisor.
How many people are injured?
Two. That I know of. I was sitting, we were rehearsing, and it went off, and I ran out.
Accidentally shot?
On a movie set with a prop gun. The fucking AD, it was his responsibility. Not a word about Alec Baldwin. While they're en route, police, EMS, the cast and crew are outside, trying to figure out what happened, frantic, talking to those responsible for the prop and its safety. The armorer is yelling, sorry. Halls, the first assistant director, is panicked. The prop master, Sarah Zachary, I don't know exactly where she is at that point, but they check the gun feverishly. They take the ammo out of the gun. They look at it, what the heck happened? They go back to the prop cart that houses the ammo. They're touching the gun and manipulating the gun, emptying it. They go and move some stuff off the prop cart, trying to figure it out. Sarah Zachary, the head of props, will tell you she threw some stuff out. And eventually, of course, EMS and police arrive pretty soon thereafter. And Helena Hutchins and Joel Souza, the director, are transported to the hospital where Helena tragically passes away. And I'm not going to be asking questions about her condition after she was wounded or the medical interventions that followed. Her injuries, the efforts to revive her, are not in dispute in this case. The evidence will be there. The prosecutor may present some of these emotionally charged images, but we're not going to be asking questions about that, and it's not an issue in dispute in this case. You jurors are allowed to ask yourselves whether or not that should be the focus or the focus should be the evidence. So police enter the scene. They have lapel cameras. Thank God they have lapel cameras. You want to see what happens? The evidence will show you can play the videotape. Want to see if they take the right gun? Play the videotape. Want to make sure what the people said or did, they're remembering correctly? Play the videotape. And so they immediately recover the prop gun and they secure it. That's off to the side. And the reason that you preserve things in the moment is so that you know what existed in the moment, the evidence in the moment, the people and the witnesses and what they said in the moment. These folks, the members of Rust, they'd never been through anything like this before. That is why what they originally said matters so much in this case. If you remember anything I say today as the evidence proceeds, remember that. Look at the evidence of what the people of Rust said and did that day. Life changes, memories change. There are human motivations, internal pressure, external pressure. That's why preservation is so important. So the police continue. In terms of the prop cart and the prop ammo that's on the cart, it's manipulated, altered, kind of messy. At this accidental shooting on a movie set, the police begin to make some mistakes. No one had ever investigated a prop gun on a movie set before. They recover the prop gun, but they don't wear gloves. They don't have the prop car inside the crime scene. Someone moves it onto the crime scene. People start touching it and showing, okay, this is a dummy, this is a blank. And then they make another mistake that matters in this case with some more significance, which is that they don't secure the prop truck that houses the cart. See, that cart that they roll off comes from a truck where all of the ammunition, all of the firearms are, and that's where they're stored. They don't secure the prop truck for several days. And then the prop house that supplies the truck, that supplies the cart, they don't secure for over a month. A lot of mistakes. They had never investigated a case in a movie set. But they had the prop gun. That was key. And so they needed to figure out where the live bullet came from. They had the shell casing, Starline Brass. That's the sort of make. You'll hear that phrase, Starline Brass. And the police were right to focus on that. That was the lethal element. And so they work outward. Makes good enough sense. Folks around the ammo and the gun to be interviewed at the precinct. The armorer at the precinct. She loaded the live bullet. Halls, head of safety. He double checked. And Alec walks up to the police. You'll see this early today. And he says, I'm here. Whatever you want to do, whatever you need me to do, just tell me where to go. And Sarah Zachary, the prop master who threw out the stuff at the cart, they missed her that night. To bring to the precinct, but the rest of them at the precinct. And thankfully, we have the lapel cameras.
And then they cleared the gun outside after his request, and I witnessed them clear it and saw the bullets.
Okay.
So the one was
the one that was yesterday, the one that fired, we don't know, but all the other ones were proper.
I can pause this. I can turn this off.
That was just a quick snapshot of the scene.
Mike, one of the things that was so difficult on this crime scene, because you would have needed, 50 officers to freeze the whole set, because I don't know how many crew members, how many actors, how many people were on that, but you want to speak to every single person. And you also do not want the people involved to talk to each other, which is going on. It's going on live. And I know that the defense attorney won't point that out, but so you need tons of police personnel. And obviously, they didn't have that. And to freeze this crime scene, also people are touching things, you never bring something back into the crime scene. If the crime scene, if it wasn't there, you don't bring it back into it, because for expediency, the crime scene has to be preserved exactly the way it is. But it was nearly impossible with the amount of personnel that the police had that responded. Also, all of crime scene protocols, they take a back seat to the preservation of life. And that is the most important thing, was to make sure they treated Helena Hutchins and to try and save her life and try to save Joel Souza's life, because that takes priority over everything. Once they're removed from the scene, all right, now freezing that crime scene was no easy thing, because again, there's all of these people are moving about talking to each other. They shouldn't also be talking to each other, but guess what? The New Mexico police are doing the very best they can with the cards they're dealt in this incident. Your thoughts?
Yeah, Billy, you and I and Phil have seen this. People shot out in the street in the Bronx or in Manhattan when I was a sergeant. You know, we have a lot more officers that we could use to secure a crime scene. We got the tape. We got the radio cars. We can put them all around. I put garbage cans around crime scenes to try to get people to stay away. You know, you're dealing with a fairly remote area. They don't have a lot of cops out there. There may be, you know, just the county cops. They may have they're coming. You know, they might not have gotten to that scene for a while. In New York City, you may get a 911 call, and within 90 seconds, you've got cops all over the place on that crime scene. There, it takes a while to get there. You've got to save the people first. We've seen this. The spent brass gets kicked around. Things get lost. Furniture gets moved. The paramedics got to be in there first. They're in charge, as far as I'm concerned, when they're working on somebody who's shot. They dictate for that. I try to keep everybody back as the sergeant, as the officer. So there's going to be a lot of manipulation of what's going on there. You get Helena Hutchinson out of there and Joel Souza out of there as fast as you can. Now somebody's got to accompany them to the hospitals because there may be dying declarations. You don't know. You want to talk to them if they live. There's people all over the place chatting with each other, talking, oh my God, I can't believe what happened. And you don't have enough officers to isolate each and every person to say, do not talk to anybody. I need a statement from you over here. You know, when you see these shows on TV, there's always enough personnel around there. They're always in charge of the crime scene. It's always a fairly calm crime scene. There's a way to get these people isolated. But you see, people are talking to each other, kind of helping each other, maybe inadvertently altering the memories of everybody. So,
Mike, I also think it was interesting that the defense attorney played the 911 call where
shocked.
The person that made the call said she pointed the finger right at the assistant director and the armorer right out of the box. Okay, that's their job. They were negligent, and two of them, one found guilty after trial, one of them pled guilty. This is the third piece. And what this trial is trying to determine whether or not the criminal negligence of Alec Baldwin rises to the level of recklessness, which is criminally negligent homicide. The way it is, the statute is that it has to be done recklessly. Was his conduct reckless? Right. And that's what the defense attorney is trying to distance him from. And that's the only thing that the jury will have to decide. Was his conduct reckless? We already know. Now they're trying to blame the police. What did the police do? Did they have a sloppy crime because they didn't have enough personnel to respond to the scene? Probably over 100 people on the crew and staff and actors and all of that stuff. How do you separate all of them when maybe you respond with 5 or 10 police officers? Almost impossible. And try to interview each person separately without another person listening in so that they know what the other person said. So difficult. Let me go back to it, and because I want to give the defense as much play as I gave the prosecution.
Let's approach this counsel.
They consented to be good.
The attorneys are up speaking to the judge right now on a sidebar that none of us are privy to what they're saying right now. Unknown what their objections are. It could be that he put forth the statement of the 911 caller, who was also an employee of Rust. And her language was a little colorful, and she in it somewhat exonerated Alec Baldwin and blamed it right away on the 911 call on David Halls and Hannah Gutierrez Reed. So that may be what the prosecution is arguing right now. But they're coming back. The defense attorney will be back making his...
The remaining witnesses from inside the church are interviewed on the scene. They're interviewed with lapel cameras. They're interviewed by the lead detective, Detective Cano. And those witnesses, some of them will come in here and testify. And not a single one of them will tell you anything different than what I'm about to tell you about the evidence. The gun was double checked, verified it was a cold gun, not an actor's responsibility to check. Safety was ensured before. Alec was doing his practicing, his rehearsing, his movements. People manipulate and point guns on movie sets. The gun went off during the rehearsal. No one saw him intentionally pull the trigger. It was obviously a tragic accident, but Alec committed no homicide. Alec took the gun from those charged with its safety. He did not tamper with it. He did not load it himself. He did not leave it unattended. It completed his costume and his character. It was an actor handling a prop and integrating it into the character of Harlan Rust. It was a dedicated professional there, off camera, whose sole sacred responsibility was that prop safety. And Dave Halls, the head of safety, was there by her side. Everyone relied on that. And it was tragic that they let them down. He was just acting as he has done for generations, and it was the safety apparatus that failed them all. So law enforcement continues. They need to find the live bullet. That was the lethal element. So they, led by Detective Cano, execute a search warrant on the church. And that's what law enforcement does. They immediately go to a judge. They say, this is what we need to do. They go into the church urgently before anything can be altered. They're confirming it was an accident, not a crime in the church. They search for guns and ammunition, videos and photos. There was no further answer in the church. They had the prop gun. They had all those witnesses secured. Their statements are clear. Alec had committed no crime, but the bullet was a mystery. And so they focus on the bullet, the critical lethal bullet, and how did it enter the movie set. So they had the prop cart, and then they go do the warrant on the prop truck. And so at that point, and I'm going to put up a photo so that you can see who some of these individuals are. They're trying to figure out when they go to the truck, what is the source of the lethal bullet? And so they execute a warrant on the truck approximately a week later. The Seth Kenny that you heard about in the prosecutor's opening, the supplier for the set, he's there. Sarah Zachary, the prop master, she's there. And they walk through what's inside of the prop truck with law enforcement. But there's no answer to the lethal bullet. And, you know, this case then takes on, you know, all this pressure. You know, the media begins swirling. Where is the lethal bullet? How did it get on that movie set? And what about that actor, Alec Baldwin, who had nothing to do with why the bullet got on the movie set? And so police and prosecutors, they work hand in hand, meeting after meeting, trying to find the lethal bullet. Meeting with Seth Kenny. Meeting with Sarah Zachary, the prop master, the supplier, where is it? And about a month after the incident, Sarah Zachary finally sits down with law enforcement to answer some questions. And she explains to them that she threw away some stuff. She disposed of some stuff. And the prosecutors and police keep meeting, swirling media. And then at that point, they go to the last step, right? Done the cart, gone to the truck. Met with Sarah Zachary, and they go execute a search warrant on, as the prosecutor told you, PDQ, the prop house. And again, Seth Kenny's there to greet them, let them in, and they don't find the lethal bullet. They never did. And as things roll in to police and prosecutors, cell phones and photos and forensics, looking for this shiny object, they found another shiny object. Instead of trying to find the source of the lethal bullet, they focused on Mr. Baldwin. But Mr. Baldwin was like every other actor. He goes bang, bang in movies. He's told when guns are cold or not. He rehearses and acts as his character. Safety proceeds before the actor. Once the actor has the prop gun. He can handle it however a person he's acting as would. A properly cleared gun can't hurt anybody. And so they told you about some of the things that Alex said in the statements that they will take or picked out a few lines from. But he won't tell you anything different that he took a gun loaded and cleared by the armorer and the AD. He made motions with the gun as he was rehearsing. He didn't intentionally pull the trigger. The gun just went off. And he does say, I didn't have a problem with the gun before. And this idea, you know, that they said that he didn't want to check because he would offend them. You know, in this moment, he's been doing this for 40 years, the evidence will show. And he has habits. And there are also SAG guidelines that tell actors what to do and what not to do. And the SAG guidelines don't tell actors to check the gun. You will see them. That's not the actor's role. And so I guess the point that they're trying to make is that why in this specific moment he doesn't break his habit of 40 years and check it differently and sort of insult them this one time. You know, if he had done that and started playing with the gun in that way, they'd be saying, arrogant actor, why is he doing that? So they will play these statements, Alex statements. You're going to hear a man in shock and grief, a father, an artist, worried about his family. You hear he's, you know, on one of the calls, he's going to meet with the decedent's family, the Hutchins family, and he's upset about that. He will talk to law enforcement. He will call them. He doesn't need a lawyer. He didn't commit a crime. He will call them and offer to meet and speak over and over again. And ask anyone in the acting world. Actors know. Actors rely on armors and point guns and shoot guns. The Armorers Act, what they did, is clear and proven. The head of safety, you will learn, took responsibility for his verification failure. But Alec committed no homicide. So law enforcement didn't have a homicide case against Alec Baldwin. But they changed the question. You heard the prosecutor tell you about this. Did he pull the trigger? Did he pull the trigger? Did he intentionally pull the trigger? And if he did, of course, that would only make his statement incorrect. Right? That would mean he would have misspoke, been incorrect. You know, and I want to stop for a moment and just tell you, because you're going to hear a lot of testimony, expert testimony, like the prosecutor told you, about the gun functioning imperfectly. Did he let the hammer down when he cocked it? Did he hit the trigger? Did he, in a calculated manner, as the prosecutor made a motion, you know, fire the gun like that? And when this issue is discussed, it's easy to sort of pull yourself into courtroom land and away from a movie set. On a movie set, you're allowed to pull the trigger. So even if he intentionally pulled the trigger like the prosecutor just demonstrated, that doesn't make him guilty of homicide. He did not know or have any reason to know that gun was loaded with a live bullet. That's the key. That live bullet is the key. That is the lethal element. But again, as the prosecutor told you, if they could prove that he intentionally pulled the trigger and he was imperfect, imprecise, wrong with what he said, then maybe you take that and you say he's lying. And if he's a liar, he committed homicide. And so what they do is they take the prop gun. They're blinded by the shine. They're blinded by trying to disprove Alec. They take it and they order a destructive test on the firearm. They order the FBI to take a test that they know will destroy the firearm. It's a pointless, unnecessary test where they blindly try to make this big case by taking a mallet and smashing the firearm. At the time that they did that, they knew that Alec had maintained, adamantly maintained, that he was manipulating the hammer and the gun just went off. That the witnesses said it went off out of nowhere. That there are these accidental discharges that happen on the set. That guns have issues in the real world. That this gun had a hair trigger. And the owner's manual of this specific gun actually says that if you load it with a live round or any round in the chamber, in that last position, and you drop it like you see a cowboy in a movie, this type of old cowboy gun can accidentally go off. I don't remember hearing anything about that. The evidence will show that. So rather than trying to answer the question of what happened, they proceed with the destructive test. They eliminate the one item that could prove what Alex said and believed. They didn't offer him a chance to test the gun. They didn't take the gun apart before they broke it and destroyed it and look at its inner workings. They didn't turn on their videotape. They just destroyed it can't ever be tested in the same condition it was in that day, won't ever allow Alec to show his truth. And the destruction of this gun that you will hear in this evidence is symbolic of this entire case. Because the officers will tell you at that point, they weren't really investigating anymore. They were trying to disprove Alec, to get Alec, to have this day. And so after the destruction of the firearm, they hired some expert witnesses you heard about to pick up the pieces, so to speak. And the state retained Lucian Haig, an expert with over half a century of experience. And he will come into court and he will tell you he's never seen anything like this in his entire career. They conducted a pointless test, a test that would lead to inevitable destruction of the firearm. There were other correct tests that they could have done to prove whether or not it could have accidentally discharged. None of the experts can test the gun in the condition it was in on the day in question. Why? Not because of something that Alec Baldwin or the crew members of Rust did. They were all clear. The gun just went off. But because of something that law enforcement did, and they deprived him of that opportunity. However, Lucian Haig will tell you that in his analysis, he did find modification that he thought likely pre-existed the FBI testing. And what that modification means and how it impacted the gun is hard to perfectly know, of course, but it was a modification on an important part, the critical part of the firearm. And it was important enough for them to put into a report and to write a new opinion about. They felt this revelation had to be sent to prosecutors. And they maintained that position that this modification was a matter of import for almost a year. And then a few weeks ago before trial, they just took it back. They just took it back. You will get to see the circumstances of that take back. How far they would go for the shiny object. They never solved the question of the lethal bullet. They destroyed the gun, and all they were left with is Alec Baldwin and the movie they intend to put on. But because they never solved the lethal bullet, they eliminated the prop gun, there will not be one witness, not one shred of evidence in this trial that Alec knew or should have known the gun was loaded with a live round. So they can't prove. They can't prove their high-profile homicide case. So they will proceed to then here and now tell you about other things, other evidence that you will hear that has nothing to do with what happened in the church on October 21st, that the movie set as a whole was improper or anything, that they hired the wrong armorer, I think I heard in opening. The evidence will show that the armorer was hired by somebody else, trained by somebody else, had done gun scenes on Rust with somebody else before Alec even got there. She was the daughter and the apprentice of the most famous and well-respected armorer in Hollywood. And she had just left serving, being an armorer for Nicolas Cage on another Western. Then they'll come in and they'll say, but what about the movie guidelines? You heard about Mr. Jorgensen and the movie guidelines, that one of the protocols wasn't followed, or there was a set safety issue about something unrelated to this. Like these movie guidelines on a set are the things of Navy SEALs and NASA. The guidelines were followed. They followed the safety guidelines. Actors don't check the weapons. Safety is ensured by dedicated personnel. So they will say, you know, but there had been accidental discharges on the set, that guns had fired accidentally prior, not related to Alec, by the way. You know, but again, that's the people we looked at, Hanny Gutierrez-Reed's fault, Sarah Zachary's fault, perhaps, Dave Hall's fault, faults, workplace issues. Some of them will end up, and you will hear the witnesses in this case, many of them have brought civil lawsuits. You know, and you'll hear that, you know, in those civil lawsuits, they're presenting evidence to try to meet a burden, not a criminal, beyond a reasonable doubt, homicide trial burden, but they're going to try to prove their cases in civil courts. And that's where faults and accidents are, at worst, 99% worked out. Not here. But you'll hear these members of the Rust crew come in here. They'll try to make sense of this for you. Some of them have sued. Some of them are in grief. Some of them are in grief and have sued. And part of this grief they feel, that everybody feels, is understandable. And what they will do is they will tell you, you know, if only we had had a second armorer. One of them will say, if only Dave Halls had checked better. If only the camera hadn't been right there and Ms. Hutchins wasn't leaning over the camera. If only I myself did this. If only Alec did that. This is natural, their testimony. It's part of the human condition. It's part of grief.
Objection, Your Honor.
None of them knew.
Yes.
The attorney prosecutor made an objection for his line of his theory.
As I was saying, the witnesses, in their grief, will look for reasons to try to make sense of this tragedy. But again, none of them knew or should have known about the lethal bullet either. No one had any idea that it was on that set or in that gun. In that world, they were all in it together. And you will hear that none of this other stuff has anything to do with those two critical questions we started with. Why there was a live bullet on set? Why the armorer placed it in the gun, and of course, why the head of safety failed to detect it. None of it speaks to whether Alec knew or should have known those things. He didn't. No one on that set did. It was not foreseeable. You will hear that word from the witnesses and from eventually the instructions. Foreseeable. This was anything other than foreseeable. And they must prove beyond any and all reasonable doubt that this was foreseeable. Total indifference to human life, that death might occur. He's an actor. He's an actor. But here we are at a homicide trial. And so they will pull, and they will pull witnesses, and witnesses will be cross-examined. They will push themselves to the edge of truth and beyond. You know, these things about, you know, Alec didn't notice this or Alec didn't notice that. I want to make sure that you're clear on something that the evidence will show. He had been filming on that set for a handful of days. The evidence will show he had just gotten there. It's not as if he had been there for months and months and noticed things and failed things. And he had just gotten there. You don't notice every little thing when you start at a new place and when you're in the character of Harlan Rust. But they will push forward and they will have gaps in the evidence as well. Don't expect you to be hearing and for them to call the first AD head of safety. I don't know if you'll be hearing from the lead detective, Connell, who investigated this case, the lead detective, or the sergeant that supervised him, Sergeant Zook. I don't think you'll hear from Mr. Schilling, who was the lead investigator for the prosecutors. And so as you hear this, you jurors can assess about that gap of evidence. And there's one thing that I can tell you will not hear also. You will not hear from an actor or an expert in acting. And so they will play the videotapes of Alec Baldwin, the actor, acting. They will show you perhaps over and over again, him in shooting scenes, bad Alec shooting a gun the wrong way in a movie scene. They will try to get you to picture that and forget that this was a movie set in the first place. And you will see actors in a Western acting. And your mind might go to your favorite gun scene in your favorite movie. You may picture actors and actresses doing exactly what you see here. The other actors in Rust doing the same thing that Mr. Baldwin was doing. But when you come back from that moment, remember, this is a homicide trial. And you will see soon that the reason they play those videos of him over and over is because they don't have any evidence of actual homicide. And you will learn the truth. Not a day goes by when we don't wish Alec had saved your life. But never, the witnesses will tell you, in the history is something that an actor has done, intercepted a live bullet from a prop gun. No actor in history. No one could have imagined or expected an actor to do that. So just remember that truth. So when they cry out justice, justice is truth. This was an unspeakable tragedy. Alec Baldwin committed no crime. Thank you.
So I think that he did a great job. The defense attorney, there's even people in the chat saying, oh, you know, he's making some good points. He did make some good points. But I just want to – some of the things that he said, number one, he wants to focus on this. Alec didn't load the gun. True, he did not. The armorer is responsible. Absolutely. And she's in prison right now. Mm-hmm. Baldwin's conduct, that is something, yes, we have to focus upon. And it's very, showing his prior conduct on the set, seemingly firing this gun all over the place where they have videotape of it, that can be taken into consideration by the jury. Four, his conduct did not create the shooting. Well, that is what the jury will be deciding. But the attorney says, you know, fully, it didn't create the shooting. One of the things I thought was very interesting, and I never thought the defense attorney would say this, he didn't intentionally pull the trigger. That's the first time I ever heard that language said. So did he inadvertently pull the trigger? And does that rise to the level of recklessness, which is the requirement to be convicted of criminally negligent homicide? Those are the issues. Yeah. I mean, all the police whisper the this, the that, the armor. Two people already are guilty in this case. This is the whole case, is will the jury determine that Alex's conduct was reckless? That is what this case, that one word, it boils down to. Your thoughts, Mike?
Billy, I thought the defense attorney did a great job presenting the case. I thought the prosecutor did a great job, too. As I talked earlier about the length and the breadth and what was actually introduced during the opening statements is a little odd to me, being from New York, but I guess that's just the way they do it. I thought probably his strongest, the two strongest things was that he talked about the destruction of the gun and that perhaps that model having a very, very slight to the touch, kind of like a hair trigger kind of thing. I think that's going to be a bone of contention. And the fact that the FBI destroyed it, you know, they're going to be all over that. I think the other part that he said was very good was that in the New Mexico statute for criminally negligent homicide upon which he's being charged, it says a person is guilty of criminally negligent homicide if they act recklessly. Now, he used the term recklessly and he defined it properly. It's foresight. You have foresight that your actions are liable, are endangering lives, and you are disregarding a known danger. So he's going to pound that into the jury to say, look, criminally negligent homicide requires Alec Baldwin to have the ability to foresee into what he is doing, foresee that what he's doing is actually risky to someone's life. And without Alec consciously knowing that and disregarding that known danger that someone could die, then he's not guilty of criminally negligent homicide. If the jury thinks that Alex acted with foresight and thought that what he was doing could possibly endanger someone's life, and he acted anyway with full knowledge of that danger, then you could find him guilty of criminally negligent homicide. This, I think, are two really good points that the defense brought up. And I think the fact that you've got Hannah Gutierrez and David Wells already guilty, I think he's going to distance himself from them. And he talked about the bullet and, you know, the destruction of the gun, the sloppy procedures for the crime scene, and they never actually got the bullet. So that the big question is, how could a live round actually have been found on a movie set, which is totally against protocol? Very interesting. I thought he did a great job.
I know I did too, but I just don't want to lose sight of what the issues are. Then the jury will be deciding almost that one single issue. Was his conduct reckless? Because that is the statute. That is the wording used in criminally negligent homicide, that your reckless conduct created a grave risk of death and caused the death. And that is the trial in itself. You know, Mike, we've been on for an hour and 40 minutes. I think it was interesting to hear the opening statements of the prosecution. Yes. And the defense. We'll come back to this case. But it's, I don't, this case is slated, I think, to last maybe 7 or 8 days. It's not going to be like another trial that lasted 6 or 8 weeks. It's this right. is not going to last that long. And I, you know, what, just in my summation, bad, yeah, the FBI destroying the gun, that's horrible. That's never a good thing. I mean, will it become an issue in this case? It could. It could. I mean, that'll be left to the jury. Now, I mean, I think both sides has great arguments.
Sure.
It's all what the jury in this case is going to believe. And that's what it comes down to. I don't think you need final thoughts because you gave us a huge summation right there. And
I get paid by the word.
Pamela White, I'm not sure Alec could be considered acting recklessly if all he did, as Alec stated, was just doing what the script and director told him to do. But Pamela, that's where reality just collides with fantasy, because the reality is that it's a firearm and you're not supposed to point a firearm at another human being. And the other thing was, did he pull the trigger? And that will determine whether or not he was reckless or not. And again, we're not going to litigate this case right now, but those are the issues. And anyway, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This was sort of an unannounced episode of Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. I'm Bill Cannon. We'll see you soon. On behalf of myself and Professor Mike Geary, have a great day and God bless. One episode, just ain't enough.